You're listening to the Today's Family Lawyer podcast, the leading source of daily news and insight for family law practitioners in England and Wales. Sign up to our free weekly newsletter at todaysfamilylawyer.co.uk and subscribe to hear all the latest news and views from across the family law sector. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.
Hello and welcome along to the latest Today's Family Lawyer podcast. Today we've got a really interesting discussion. We're talking about costs in family proceedings, a bit of a grey area. But if you know your onions, as Nicola Rushton does, you may well navigate it well. Nicola is a senior associate at Forbes Solicitors and for the last 15 years has been specialising in high net worth family finance. Thank you very much indeed for joining the podcast, Nicola.
Thank you. Good morning, David.
I've said that we're going to be talking about costs. You're going to explain this an awful lot better than I am. But in the first instance, useful, if you wouldn't mind, just telling us a little bit more about yourself. I've said that you've been specialising in high net worth family finance, but a bit more about yourself and what your practice involves.
Yes, thank you. I qualified in 2001, initially practising family law and criminal law. That gave me a good background in all walks of life. I have specialised in divorce and family finance for the last 15 years, which includes financial remedy on divorce, but it also includes Schedule 1 applications under the Children Act for unmarried couples, particularly. Divorcing couples are often the most common aspects of my daily life. But also there are unmarried couples and there are financial remedies, of course, for them under the Married Women's Property Act. And as I say, the Schedule 1 of the Children Act. It is becoming more practical these days for people to specialise. And it used to be that a family lawyer did everything from public law to private law. But more commonly these days, everyone specialises. And certainly, it makes you a better lawyer, I think, if you specialise and choose a niche area, because practice obviously makes perfect, doesn't it? You hope.
I think you're right in terms of specialisation, really important, and particularly in costs. We've been talking before we started recording about how some of the emphasis around costs is really quite interesting and can change. So current costs rules, where typically they're not really applied, have been criticised for discouraging early settlement because, of course, there's no consequences for unreasonable mm-hmm. behaviour. Is this your view? What do you think about the?
I think that largely the current cost rules do allow some practitioners and litigants, particularly litigants in person, to run cases that don't perhaps have merits or are disproportionate to the assets. And I think that when you are faced with that sort of problem where you have a litigant in person or a professional opponent on the other side who are running cases, particularly using allegations or emotive language or inappropriate applications, you have to be incredibly careful about how you approach it yourself. You have to make sure that, for instance, if there is a correspondence written in emotive language, or if there is, say, a statement of issues alleging conduct on the other side that is completely irrelevant, you have to resist entering into that arena and using the same tactics. You can't do that. If you are going to be successful in making sure that your client doesn't have an order for costs against them, or if you want to get an order for costs against the other person, you have to be squeaky clean. So you have to conduct yourself in a way that is promoting good dialogue, working towards settlement, and be open and honest in your negotiations without being confrontational. And always bear in mind that your duty as a lawyer is to assist the court in finding what the assets are in the case and reaching an early settlement. And I think that if you remember that your conduct throughout the proceedings will be scrutinised by a judge. So you have to make sure that you're not going to do anything that can be criticised at the end of the day and fall foul of the ability of the court to make an order for costs against your client. There are exceptions to when the courts will make orders for costs. The interim proceedings, interim applications such as maintenance pending suit or interim periodical payments, you can seek costs. You have to make sure that you've done everything you can to settle before you actually make the application for an interim maintenance pending suit, and you have to make sure that your client's application has merit, and there are of course plenty of authorities about what your application should follow. In relation to interim orders, it's always a good idea to warn the other side that you're going to make the application unless they come to the table and reach an agreement. If they don't, or if they won't negotiate with you, then your application, when you make it, should include an order for costs, and you should provide the other side with a schedule of your costs. And if you do that and you succeed with your application, then your order for costs will be made. But in the long term, my view is that the costs issue at the moment do encourage people to litigate without actually thinking about the cost-benefit analysis of the case.
I mean, there's plenty of examples where cases simply run up legal bills, and at the end of the day, both sides end up relatively empty-handed. And there's the old mantra that in a divorce, only the lawyers ever win, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's a phrase I often say to clients, that you need to be careful about what you're arguing about, because the only winners will be the lawyers. The more that you can sort out between you or through mediation or in an amicable way, the better it will be for you, because there's only one pot of money and you don't want to share it with the lawyers. There is a spectacular example of a waste of costs, the case that you mentioned to me, RM and TM. And this was heard by Judge Robert Peel QC, sitting as a deputy High Court judge. And his phrase in that case, and I'll read this because it is a superb phrase, and the lawyers must have been quaking when he started saying this in court. And he said, there may be worse examples of disproportionate and ill-judged litigation, but none readily spring to mind. It's hard to express what a calamitous waste of resources this has been. And RM and TM, and I have used this to when I've been giving this as an example to clients, to say, you know, you must bear in mind proportionality. In this case, I think there were 13 applications by the husband, only three of which were successful. The legal costs were 94% of the liquid assets.
Wow.
Exactly. They were eye-watering. They were around £600,000. And at the end of the day, each party walked away with just over £5,000 in liquid assets. It's madness. It's utter madness. And there are dozens and dozens of case law citing this. And as a lawyer, you need to remember that if you run away with something, and if you do something just because your client tells you to, you may come in for criticism. So you have to bear in mind that the judge will criticise litigation conduct, and clients can fall foul of the rules that the court has. Because although there is the general rule that there should be no order for costs, it's not a bar to a judge making an order for costs if he feels the litigation conduct has been disproportionate. There is a case of OG and AG 2020 where Mosty emphasised 28A 4.4, saying that parties must negotiate openly once the financial landscape is clear. And failure to do that and simply issuing applications will mean that penalties will be made in costs against that party. And I think that on the whole, most professionals bear that in mind, but it has been hammered home in recent cases, particularly following Mostyn's ruling in OG&AG. And I think that people are becoming more mindful of running away with cases and applications. It's still a developing area. There are still some people who believe that it's the right thing to do to be aggressive. But generally, people do follow the approach that we should negotiate.
I'm going to put you on the spot now, Nicola, because I know how much lawyers like black and white. But is it right to seek costs? There's lots of grey area in family law. We've talked about this on the podcast a number of times. But is it right to seek costs?
Well, the phrase, if you don't ask, you don't get, is very useful. It is right to seek costs. It is my default position. And I think that if you don't seek costs, then you're not putting your opponent on notice that there may be consequences for them ignoring applications, not providing full disclosure, and so on. It's the same with everything. There has to be advanced disclosure. And of course, you have to set out what it is you're asking the court to do. And you have to include, I'm going to seek costs, so that it's there, it's on the table, it's available, it's an option to the judge. So yes, you should. It doesn't mean to say you'll get it. It doesn't mean to say that you pursue it. And indeed, you know, most open offers that you make during the course of your case will say, if this is accepted, then we don't seek costs. It's right to seek it. It's a tactic, and it needs to be included with every application that you make.
So here's another sort of devil's advocate question. Financial remedy proceedings are subjective by their very nature.
Absolutely.
You do get deliberate non-disclosure. I mean, you know, we could perhaps put that out there, but you do get it. How do you as a lawyer work with clients to try and ensure complete transparency? Because when I say there's deliberate non-disclosure, I don't necessarily mean the lawyer is deliberately not disclosing stuff. Ultimately, if the client's not telling you stuff, that's on them.
Yes, of course. I think it comes from experience. You very quickly learn what your client's about, because you're dealing with them at a time when they are highly emotional. And of course, the person that they share their life with, they no longer want to give them the time of day, let alone half their assets. And particularly when there's been an uneven financial balance, quite often the party with the financial clout, if you will, feels resentful that they have to share all their hard-won money with their former spouse. One of the things that you need to stress right from the outset with the client is that unless you're going to be open and honest, you'll make my job very hard, the truth will out, and you'll get found out. And if you get found out, the consequences for you will be far greater than if you are open and honest now and we disclose everything that's necessary, including things that you don't think are necessary or relevant. For instance, it's largely accepted that some small pensions in a short marriage, pre-marriage, may not be divided and will be excluded from the pot. But nevertheless, the judge needs to know because they need a full picture. And without a full picture, a judge can't make a decision. If you are going to have a client who wants to withhold that information, you need to give them clear warnings that the consequences for them could be quite dire. They could end up with cost penalties. They could end up being in contempt of court. They could be fined. I've never had that happen in a case, but I have had clients who have been found out, and the consequences are pretty grim for them, because of course, if they're found out to be being dishonest with the judge, then everything they say after that is questionable. So even when they're not being dishonest about something, how does the judge know? So it tampers everything that they may want to put in front of the court. Right from the outset, setting out for your client the consequences of not being open and honest, and also saying that it makes it so much easier and so much more pleasant to do things openly. It makes it quicker. Your litigation can be done with in months you know, one of my phrases is, if you want to carry on seeing me for another couple of years and keep paying us, keep hiding things.
What about the flip sort of side of that then, where your client is sure that the other side is not disclosing everything? That's another sort of challenge, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. And that sort of scenario is quite difficult, because without information that enables you to look at what might be being hidden. So for instance, if a client says, I know that there are lots of bank accounts that are not disclosed, there isn't the facility to go to a bank. There's not a central register of bank accounts. You can't do it. The client has to know that there might be a Santander account or a Barclays or so on, or there is a pension with British Leyland that's 10 years ago and things like that. Without a little bit of knowledge, it is a struggle. There are companies, they are niche companies that can do searches for hidden assets, both within the UK and abroad. That sort of service is quite expensive. If your client can afford it, it's well worth doing. I've done it on a couple of occasions, and we turned up a couple of properties that hadn't been disclosed, and one of which was quite valuable. So sometimes it is worth it. But just because a former spouse has been secretive doesn't necessarily mean that there are, you know, money, bank accounts, a pot of gold. It doesn't necessarily mean that. They become naturally suspicious as they become separated. So you have to have a little bit of knowledge, or perhaps a pattern of behaviour that leads you to suspect they're not disclosing everything that they should be.
So you sort of indicated that your stance is that you would seek costs in most cases. You've talked a little bit about how you might maximise those opportunities. How do you maximise the chance of obtaining costs when you seek them?
If you have an opponent that has been equally squeaky clean and has simply provided open and honest disclosure, has not been late without filing anything, or and has complied with all the court's timetable and deadlines, you're not going to get an order for costs, because of course the guidance and the rules say there shouldn't be an order for costs unless there's a good reason to do that. So I think that what you need to do is make sure that you have an eye on your opponent's conduct throughout the proceedings. And if at the end of the case, there are instances where late filing of documents, forgetting to send you documents and you have to request them, not making open offers, and all of those things are relevant. However, what you need to do is you can't raise them right at the end of the case and say, by the way, judge, 6 months ago, they didn't file their disclosure on time, etc. What you need to do is make sure that you put on record at the time that it happens, you've not done this, and we're going to bring this to the attention of the judge if this proceeds to a final hearing. So you need to, as you're going along, do this. And if your opponent is late, say filing replies to questionnaire, make an application to compel them to file it and seek an order for costs, because you're far more likely to get an order for costs then as an interim application than when you get to the final hearing, when the judge has done the careful calculation about who should have what and who needs what and so on. And then you say, but 6 months ago, judge, they were late, they incurred more costs because we incurred more costs because of their behaviour. So please give us an order for costs. The judge has already done his or her decision and is more likely to say, well, actually, we've moved on since then, and so I'm not going to make an order for costs. So you have to think all the way through. If there is something that happens that derails the progress, can I make an application, and should I be notifying the other side, this is how much costs we've incurred as a result of your failure to do X, Y, Z, and we're going to ask the court to make the order at the end of the case. That's the way to do it, just to keep an eye on the progress of the case.
So conversely, you're ensuring that you're not filing late, you're ensuring that you're not doing anything untoward. Mm-hmm. That's a preventative measure to protect your own client from costs as well.
Yes, yes, indeed. And it sometimes can be quite exhausting because clients find the proceedings difficult. They're going through the breakdown of the relationship. It's very difficult for them. The last thing they want to be doing is digging out 12 months of bank statements, chasing their pension providers, chasing their accountant, and so on. But you have to, and you have to make it clear to them that this information is needed to prevent them falling foul of the court's timetable. One thing that is often a useful thing to do is to get authorities from your client to approach their accountant, to approach their pension providers, to get the information yourself. It takes some pressure off clients. It increases the cost, but high net worth clients are generally very busy and just want to hand it over and say, you know, here you go, you do it. In the same way that I give my car keys to my car valeter and say, yes, please, you do it. It's the same sort of thing. It's, you know, that's what I do every day. And they prefer me to extract the information from their advisor that we need. And that is often a far more effective way of managing the timetable and sticking to it. You can say to the accountant, this is the information I need, and I need it by such a date. Is there a problem with that date? And if the accountant says, there's no way we can meet that deadline, well, then you can go to the other side, hopefully get an agreement to extend, or if not, notify the court that you're in some difficulties. Quite often a judge will be quite prepared to give an extension without the necessity of an application. As long as you keep the court in the loop, you don't fall foul of the cost rules.
You've talked about the fact that in the proceedings, you're looking at the other side, you're looking at perhaps their body language, you're assessing the situation. And I'm sat here wondering whether this drive towards video court hearings is going to impact your job in a big way. I think we were just talking off camera. You were saying that you were in court historically about 3 times a week. Now it's more like 3 times a month because you're doing the video hearings. How much does that impact your role? How much does that impact your ability to gauge the case?
My view is that if you have a financial dispute resolution hearing on a Teams meeting, in the last couple of years, I cannot think of a single FDR that has actually settled on the day. I think it loses something. When we have had contested hearings on Teams meetings in the depth of the pandemic, it was utterly disastrous because the nuances, as you say, the body language, when someone is answering questions, I've sat there and watched a judge making notes, and I can see the person who's giving the evidence or the other person who's not giving evidence, and I can see both faces and the reactions. And of course you get that when you're in court, you see that. But the judge didn't see it because the judge was writing and didn't glance up in time to see what was on the screen, because of course you lose what is that personal touch. And I think the courts are, particularly Manchester Court, is now saying that all but the first hearings have to be attended. And it's a good thing. When you're in an FDR, generally before the pandemic and before this tendency to have Teams hearings, you would go to court bright and early at 9 a.m. and you know you would spend most of the day there wearing the carpet out negotiating. But I would say 99 out of 100 cases settled, and save the parties vast amounts of costs by having a contested hearing. It may just be me, but I think that largely most of my colleagues agree at least half now don't settle, which is huge. And of course, given the delays in the court's listing, it means that people are now facing hearings 6 months from now. And that in itself has an added cost burden, because we have to get updating disclosure between the last filing of disclosure right up to the hearing. So it adds another layer of costs. You then have to go through your opponent's disclosure as you did in the first place. These Teams meetings are super for us as lawyers in terms of travelling around the country. We're not sat hanging around at court, but in terms of settling, it doesn't help. And it certainly doesn't help when you've got contested hearings and people giving evidence.
That's really interesting. Thanks very much for sharing that, Nicola. We'd probably be able to talk about this for most of the rest of the day. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. It's been fabulous to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me.
The Today's Family Lawyer podcast is available on your preferred podcast provider. It's also available on todaysfamilylawyer.co.uk. Thank you to Nicola. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you again soon.
You're listening to the Today's Family Lawyer podcast, the leading source of daily news and insight for family law practitioners in England and Wales. Sign up to our free weekly newsletter at todaysfamilylawyer.co.uk and subscribe to hear all the latest news and views from across the family law sector. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.